ready to get started, Kevin?
I'm ready to go.
All right, we'll just push everything back 30 minutes, and by that standard, we're starting 5 minutes early as I welcome you at long last to this month's installment of TOQ Live. Thanks for being patient with us, everybody. We shall overcome. I'm your host, James Edwards, joined by my good friend and colleague, Dr. Kevin McDonald. Now, you know that the purpose of our monthly YouTube series here is to feature and promote the work of the contributors to the Occidental Quarterly Print Magazine. Well, we're doing that tonight in a grand way because we are shining the spotlight solely on Dr. McDonald himself, and for very good reason. He has just released his most recent masterpiece, his latest book, hot off the shelves and ready for your purchase right now. And that's what we're going to be talking about tonight for the next hour, and then we'll take your questions for the final half hour. So 90 minutes with Kevin McDonald one-on-one. I can't wait. Kevin, how are you?
I'm just fine, James. Just looking forward to it.
All right. Well, we did this. I'm going to try to do it very quickly, if you don't mind. A formal introduction for our good friend. I know he's known to this home crowd, but just for the sake of those who may be tuning in for the first time, and there are always people who are doing that, Kevin McDonald is a retired professor of psychology at California State University, Long Beach. After receiving a master's degree in evolutionary biology, he received a PhD in biobehavioral sciences, both at the University of Connecticut. Since assuming his position at California State University, Long Beach, his research focused on developing evolutionary perspectives on culture, developmental psychology, and personality theory, the origins and maintenance of monogamous marriage in Western Europe, and ethnic relations or group evolutionary strategies. He's the author of more than 100 scholarly papers and reviews, in addition to editing 3 books in the areas of developmental psychology and evolutionary psychology. He is the author of Social and Personality Development, an Evolutionary Synthesis, A People That Shall Dwell Alone, Judaism as a Group Evolutionary Strategy, Separation and Its Discontents Toward an Evolutionary Theory of Antisemitism, and The Culture of Critique, an Evolutionary Analysis of Jewish Involvement in 20th Century Intellectual and Political Movements. Currently, Dr. McDonald serves as the editor-in-chief of the Occidental Quarterly and his own e-zine, theoccidentalobserver.net. His current book, hot off the press, as I said, and just now available for your purchase online, is Individualism and the Western Liberal Tradition, Evolutionary Origins, History, and Prospects for the Future. Kevin, it is great to have you on, to be able to focus exclusively and celebrate the release of your brand new book. And congratulations to you for that tremendous accomplishment.
I appreciate that, James. It's sort of a work of, it's sort of a labor of love, which has been going on for about 40 years, because I started writing about these topics in the 1980s. Along with a lot of other things, you know, and an awful lot of people, when they think of me, they think of, well, this is the guy who writes about Jews. Well, I've written about a lot of other things. And this is about the West, and it's about us. And it's a very difficult topic. I think a lot of cultures are pretty simple. You sort of understand them. And but Western history is complex, and it's dynamic, and I'm trying to get a grip on it from an evolutionary perspective is a daunting task. And I think that it's this kind of thing that will have to be revised in the future, but I think it's a start, and we'll see what how people react to it.
Well, just to give you a little more information about the book, and then we're going to do a deep dive into its contents and the inspiration behind it with the author himself, Dr. McDonald. The book, again, it's available on Amazon. Individualism and the Western Liberal Tradition argues that ethnic influences are important for understanding the West. The prehistoric invasion of the Indo-Europeans had a transformative influence on Western Europe, inaugurating a prolonged period of what is labeled aristocratic individualism, resulting from variants of Indo-European genetic and cultural influence. However, beginning in the 17th century and gradually becoming dominant was a new culture labeled egalitarian individualism, which was influenced by pre-existing egalitarian tendencies of Northwestern Europeans. Egalitarian individualism ushered in the modern world, but may well carry the seeds of its own destruction. So the table is set. introductions have been made. Let's get down into the meat of this book. Kevin, when did you start writing it, and what was the original motivation behind it?
Well, as I said in my little spiel a minute ago, I started writing this stuff in the 1980s. As an evolutionary psychologist, I was really interested in monogamy because if you look around the world at the advanced societies, China, India, Muslim societies, they are all polygynous. If a man is wealthy, powerful, they have many wives or concubines. Harems are very, very common. So successful males, and there's a lot of evolutionary theory behind that, and it was a big topic in the early 80s. But, I'm looking around and I'm saying to myself, well, that's interesting and it's true, but it doesn't really apply to Western Europe. Western Europe is and has been monogamous for a very long period of time. So I started writing about monogamy. And I published several papers in the 1980s and 90s about that. So that was really the origin of it. But also I was in child development. And so I wrote a couple of papers on the history of the family, very interested in the history of the family and how children were socialized at different times, which was another topic that was gaining traction in developmental psychology at the time. We tend to think of, if you think about, almost all the research in child development is on children in the 20th century from the 1970 or 60 onwards in America, mostly in white kids. That is not really what, it does not really describe how kids were reared in Puritan England, in the 17th century or something like that. So there's a lot of variation there. So I was very interested in how children were socialized. So all that led to thinking about those issues. And then it just took off from there. Got interested in other things, very influenced by Ricardo Duchesne's work on the Indo-Europeans. It's been a long adventure and very interesting. I hope readers agree with that.
Well, you can do as I did today, ladies and gentlemen. If you go to Amazon.com, you don't have to remember the title.
Here's a picture of the book.
You can just put in Kevin MacDonald book, and this, his latest, will come right up to the top of the charts. And as I said, I'm going to be taking a deep dive into it, focusing exclusively on it for the next hour, and then for 30 minutes beyond that, there it is. Kevin's holding it up. What a beautiful cover. Great illustration, great font. We're going to be taking your questions for Kevin about the book, if there's something I failed to cover here in my line of questioning. Now, you touched on it, Kevin. You have a chapter on the population genetics of Europe. What were some of the main points of that?
Well, the main points is that Europe was colonized, settled by three very different groups of people. The first group were the hunter-gatherers. They were there from like 45,000 years ago. And then, of course, the glaciers came and they had to retreat to the south, and then they came back after the glaciers. But that's the primordial population of Europe. Then about 8,500 years ago or so, you had farming peoples from the Middle East come. They came through Anatolia, modern Turkey, came up through the south east of Europe and settled in the south and gradually moved north. And they basically dominated these hunter-gatherers that had been there previously. Didn't entirely wipe them out. They merged with them to some extent. But then around 2500 BC or so, you had this massive invasion from the steppes of Ukraine, the modern state of Ukraine, the Pontic steppes, of a new people, the Indo-Europeans, just very successful military culture. These people conquered all of Europe eventually. They went east all the way to Western China, down, they conquered India, Iran, all those areas. And they gave them their languages. Sanskrit's an Indo-European language in India. And all the European languages derived from Indo-Europe. All the European languages derived from the European roots. So it's a fascinating story. So basically the first chapter is about how much admixture there is. And one of the main findings is that there's a what we call a climb from south to north in terms of the representation of these farmers and hunter-gatherers and the Indo-Europeans. In the South, these farmers are much more prevalent. I mean, if you go to Sardinia, it's like 95% of the farmers, the farming ancestry. They do the population genetics now. Then, as you move north, there's more hunter-gatherer, more Indo-European. And especially as you get to the far north, more hunter-gatherer. There's in Scandinavia, particularly interested in that, because in general, one of the big findings of the book or hypotheses of the book is that Scandinavian cultures are extreme within Europe. And that at the opposite extreme, you have the cultures of Southern Europe, which were basically the farmer ancestry. So the argument of the book it essentially is that what we see in the present world and throughout history, looking at family history and so on, reflects this biological population genetic climb between the South and the North. So it's a fascinating story.
Well, you were just touching on the Indo-Europeans and how incredibly important they were as a group, not just for Europe, but for much of Asia. You talked a little bit about their culture and their success. Yeah. But would they be what you describe as exemplifying aristocratic individualism? And what exactly do you mean by that term?
Yeah, aristocratic individualism. This is the term that comes from Ricardo Duchesne, Professor Ricardo Duchesne, who's very influential with me. I say it quite a few times in the book. He's a professor from the University of New Brunswick in Canada. He was recently retired from his job under pressure from the political correct thing. For decades, after World War II, anybody who said that the Indo-Europeans were a people, anyone like that was branded as a Nazi or something like that. That was like verboten. You could not say that in polite company. And so for a long time, the Indo-Europeans were regarded as these language teachers, or they had this wonderful culture that people emulated, you know, and they peacefully disseminated their culture and language. No, this was an extremely militarized culture. And it was aristocratic in the sense that there was this elite at the top of the culture. It was quite hierarchical and competitive. And especially among males, competed to form these military groups. The whole society was dedicated to military conquest and prowess. And so men would compete to get followers. And of course they would have to be talented to get followers. It was a free market society. It wasn't based on despotism. Like when you go to the East, you know, if you go to Iran or places like that, there the new European culture kind of degenerated in a way that they didn't really have that individualistic bent. It became much more despotic. But in Europe, it really was a free market culture where men who could command, have a military command a following, they got followers and they gave their followers gifts. It was reciprocal. It wasn't by force. It wasn't despotic. And these people were extremely successful. And wherever they went, basically. And they set up various kingdoms in Europe. Rome was an Indo-European society. Greece was an Indo-European society. So it was pervasive within Europe. It was aristocratic in the sense, as I say, that you had this, it's very hierarchical. And so that you had this elite at the top. When they conquered people, a big thesis in my book is that they didn't exterminate them. They dominated them and used them for labor and various things. Yeah, this was a slaveholding society. But at the same time, there was upward mobility. And people who were, say, what we call peasants or serfs or something like that, could achieve upward mobility. If you had military talent, you could rise. If you had leadership talent, you could rise. If you had other kinds of talent, you could rise. So it was very much of a free market, individualist society going way back. So it was, again, it was not despotic at all. And within this aristocratic group, it was egalitarian. The person who was leading it was first among equals. He was not a despot. He didn't force people to do much of anything. They could defect anytime they want. they wanted. And so if there was another man who was really successful, they would defect to him. But this was a very successful culture. We can see it at this time that the seeds of capitalism and free markets and individualist economic activity and that sort of thing. That's essentially what individualism is getting away from kinship as being the dominant factor in human relations, as is so common around the world. And if you go to Africa, almost all of Asia, China, the Muslim world, certainly India, all these cultures are based fundamentally on kinship. And Europe stands out. It is unique. And that's why it has puzzled people for so long. That's why it is still, you know, it's still, an enormous intellectual challenge to try to figure it out. But they were egalitarian among themselves, but they did not produce egalitarian societies. It was very hierarchical and it was a steep climb to the top, but people who were talented could rise. Go ahead.
Well, no, I was just going to say, reminding folks, since we did have a little late start due to technical difficulties, we're not going to cut anything short. In fact, we're going to give you a little bit more than normal. And in about 45 minutes time, we're going to be opening up the floor for those of you in the chat room to ask Kevin your questions. So stay tuned for that. You mentioned, Kevin, in your answer just then, you mentioned Rome. Rome is a particularly interesting Indo-European culture. You make a big point about how open Roman culture was to incorporating new peoples and gradually giving rights to commoners or individuals from lower social classes. How did this contribute to Roman success, and why did this strategy ultimately fail?
Well, yeah, that's, you know, I have a long appendix to the second chapter in the New Europeans about Rome. And that's essentially what it's all about. Rome was very unlike Greece, for example. Greece was much more closed in. The city-states did not admit people readily. They were very ethnocentric, really. The Romans, though, were very expansive. So they started out very small, you know, right around Rome, started conquering people. When they conquered them, they not only didn't exterminate them or even really enslave them. They didn't enslave certainly some people. But basically the idea was to incorporate them into the military, and so people in the conquered areas could rise, especially if they were important people in the conquered culture. They could rise pretty readily, within a generation or two. They might be in the Roman Senate. They were admitted as citizens. They had military responsibilities. And that's what allowed Rome to expand. They gradually built up a huge army that they never could have built up just by themselves. They when they would conquer these groups, they would go out and they would recruit them essentially on their side. And the same with slaves. I mean, they would bring in scads of slaves as they expanded. But gradually these slaves got manumitted, and they could rise, they became citizens eventually. That was in the empire quite a long ways afterwards, I think 212 AD. But, even within Rome, I mean, you had the patricians and the plebeians. The plebeians, there was conflicts between the orders for a long time. But gradually the plebeians started to have some real upward mobility. And pretty soon you started having plebeians in the Senate. They abolished laws saying you couldn't have marriage between patricians and plebeians. And it became much more, of a sort of, there's input from a wide range. Again, this was not a despotic society, especially during the Roman Republic, which lasted until around the birth of Christ. So this was a very open society. And it really was a strategy. It was an evolutionary strategy, I call it, because it was a way of conquering other people. Again, they could never have done this if they had just remained provincial all by themselves. That's why the Greeks could never really expand very far. They could never expand beyond Greece very well. They create a lot of trading networks and so on, but they didn't expand like the Romans did. And so that's essentially, but in the end it failed. And the reason being that they kept bringing all these other people in. And really by the end of the Republic, the original people who founded Rome and were responsible for its greatness had largely disappeared. And certainly by, say, the second century AD, you had a big replacement of people. And people from all over, you know, they conquered, you know, North Africa, the Middle East, a long ways into Asia. So there was a huge melting pot of people brought into Rome. And in the long run, the original families weren't there anymore. And of course, that was coupled with the fact that, mortality was high in the ancient world. You had to, infant mortality, even for wealthy people, was very high. And as the Republic wore on, and especially during the Empire, you had a lot more sort of sexual degeneracy and a lot less, the early Roman Republic was quite moral and very hardworking, responsible. And I quoted a couple paragraphs from Theodore Mommsen, the great Roman historian, in the last chapter of the book, basically saying that the Roman aristocracy was incredibly responsible. They were incredibly good. They worked for the good of the whole. They were not selfish and just an incredible group. But all that disappeared, and essentially you had a population turnover. It's a harbinger for what could happen to the West again, of course.
Ladies and gentlemen, the name of the book, again, is Individualism and the Western Liberal Tradition, Evolutionary Origins, History, and Prospects for the Future. I've been looking down a little bit, trying to manage in the chat room, getting the new link promoted to social media, because some of those links were obsolete. Actually, Kevin, if you could, a little point of information here, if you could retweet just that last one I sent out one more time, the most recent one at the top of my feed, that's going to be the newest link that actually works. So that's that. Now, one thing about this book that I really like is that in addition to talking about several different aspects of importance to our people, you're talking about evolutionary origins, prospects for the future, but it could be classified as a history book. And I love reading about the history of our people. As I said in a joint appearance that you and I made a few weeks back, I often lay in bed at night reading history. I read it. I love to digest it. And you've met my wife, Kevin, so you know how disciplined a man must be to stay on his studies when you have that within close proximity. But I love reading history books, and this is certainly that. And to that end, you argue that there have been two main influences on European culture, as we were just talking about, the Indo-European with their aristocratic individualism and the Northern hunter-gatherers with their egalitarianism individualism. What was Northern hunter-gatherer culture like, and why is it still important?
Well, the main thing is egalitarian. They were not aristocratic at all. If you think about hunter-gatherer groups around the world, they tend to be egalitarian wherever they are. And these hunter-gatherer groups evolved in the far north of Europe, go through the winter, you have to plan. They created a culture that, again, it was not based on kinship. It was based on creating a community of like-minded people. What I call a moral community. This is based on the anthropologist James, forget his name right now, but the point is that these hunter-gatherer groups are really moral communities. They're not based on kinship, but they're based on reputation. Sort of like the Indo-Europeans, where your reputation is everything. Are you a good military leader? Are you a good soldier? Here, though, the emphasis is on what's your reputation? Are you an honest person? Can you be trusted? Are you a moral person? Trust is very important. Hunter-gatherer societies tend to make to make decisions by consensus, that everyone agrees on a plan of action. There's no despot there. And if someone tries to rise up and become a despot, they quickly get knocked down. And this is true around the world. So hunter-gatherer groups tend to be egalitarian. And this, these groups really were submerged in European history. Again, they're more extreme. They're more influenced in the far north. That's why I see Scandinavian society as an outlier. It's extreme within the European context. But it they are, I would say, the main thing, again, is the egalitarianism, but also the fact that you have high trust within the group. And a very interesting thing, that why that would develop, why that individualistic culture would develop. I work on this, in Chapter 3. And this is, I wouldn't say this is absolutely nailed down, but it's fascinated by this data that these hunter-gatherer groups were not able to you know, dominate a resource like, say, in China or the Egyptians in the Nile River, the Tigris, Euphrates, and those bases. All the ancient civilizations developed around a big resource, like a river or something like that, that they could dominate. And then what would happen is a particular kinship group would dominate it, and those societies would then become the typical despotic societies based on kinship and exploitation. But in Europe, there was no big resource to really dominate. These cultures tended they would gather during some of the year to shellfish and fish by the ocean, and there would be big groups. So very complex societies. They weren't little band groups like families. So these are complex hunter-gatherer groups, which exist in several other parts of the world, but this is the only one I know of. It really is not based on kinship. So, but these groups could not control this area by the sea for any length of time. So during the year, they would migrate inland in the small family groups. So you never had that development of a one kinship group really being able to dominate a rich resource. That's my theory anyway, about why the far north retained its fundamental individualism. But again, an egalitarian individualism based on a hunter-gatherer model, not the kind of the aristocratic individual they're talking about at the end of the Europeans. Very different culture.
Kevin, I just put a link to the purchase, the purchase link to for folks to get your book in the chat room. I noticed that as we sit right now broadcasting live, that your book is ranked quite highly on the Amazon.com bestsellers list. In fact, in the category of Scandinavian history, it is ranked number 2. And I have a question about the Scandinavians coming up, but I want to take a brief parenthetical departure to encourage those of you watching us live, those of you who will be watching us later when this is posted hither and yon, to support the work of Dr. McDonald by buying this book. This man is a national treasure. He could have lived a very comfortable life of peace and tranquility, but rather he chose to do his duty and to stand up and fight for a cause greater than himself. The least we can do, I think, is support him by buying this book. And believe me, you will be the one who benefits the most from it. A basic aspect of the book is the chapter on the family structure. How does variation in family structure within Western Europe correspond to genetic differences between Northwestern and Southern Europe?
Yeah, as I said, in the chapter on population genetics, I established, based on a lot of research, really, that there's this north-south cline in the genetics. And in chapter 4, then, I talk about the family. Again, this goes back to the 1980s where I started doing this research, but now I really got informed genetically by the recent population genetic research. And basically what you see in the family history is a north-south family clan, historically, with Scandinavia being extreme on one end, and what we call, I called it extreme individualism, And then on the southern end, you have what I call moderate collectivism, which, you know, again, the southern end, they tended to come from the Middle East, the farmers back 8,500 years ago, and they were much more clan-oriented, much more kinship-oriented. And so despite, being in Europe for all these millennia, and despite being conquered, you know, by, say, the Franks in the Middle Ages, and part of the Roman Empire and all that, they retained this collectivist family structure, even into the present. So, that in the Middle Ages, you would have these what they call hostels, and they were based on an extended family and much more kinship oriented, much more like what you'd see in Southeastern Europe, similar to Eastern Europe. Similar, but less so than what you see in the Middle East. Middle East is the most collectivist part of the world, in my opinion, of any part. But the Southern Europe is quite collectivist. There's a line between within France, separating Northern France from Southern France, and it's been known for a very long time. Historians in the 19th century, et cetera, commented on it, that there's this difference in culture. And language between the two. You think of France as one unit, but it's not at all. Actually, I think that's a mistake that some people make when they do the population genetics. They don't separate the two because these are very different cultures and I think very different peoples. So even though they were conquered by the Franks, which was basically centered in Northern Europe, in Germany, what we call Germany now, but it spread, had the Frankish Empire, Charlemagne and all that, really conquered much of Europe, and including Southern Europe, but it didn't change their fundamentally collectivist structure. You see the same thing in Southern Italy, but not interestingly in Northern Italy, which is much more Germanic. This is the Lombards in the Po Valley, much more Germanic, and you see more individualistic social structure. So again, I'm inclined to see this as reflecting these genetic differences. There's no studies that you're actually linking the genetics there, but the fact that it reflects so closely this genetic climb, very interesting to me. Again, when you see if you look at Northern France, you look at North Germany, England, much more influence of the Germanic peoples. And they are what we call moderately individualistic. They're not as extreme as the Scandinavians, but they are definitely individualistic. There's a little section, for example, contrasting Ireland with the British who came over. This is a study during the Middle Ages, like 14th, 15th, 16th century, finding that Ireland much more clan oriented. Imagine the same is true in Scotland, but the Germanic areas much more individualistic. Kinship was not as important. In kinship societies, it's all based on the family and the clan and all that. In individualistic societies, it's based more on civic organizations. Organizations that are open to everyone. They're not really based on kinship, based on common interests, church societies, stamp collecting, whatever. So that's the kind of difference that we see. And again, very clear differences within Europe, corroborated by recent research on the family.
Well, you mentioned church groups, so that actually leads into my next question. So it's quite common, of course, among people on the dissident right to disparage Christianity, the Catholic Church, particularly given its recent propagandizing on behalf of third world migration. But let's face it, the Christian church, Europe was also known as Christendom, is an important part of the story of Western culture. How do you see it?
Yeah, it's an important chapter. Chapter 5 discusses the church. Again, right at the beginning of my research in monogamy, I came to, I had to confront the fact that the church was regulating the sex lives and marriage practices of the elites in Europe. I mean, this is unprecedented. This is unique. You don't see any other culture where this religious group is able to tell the emperor, the king, no, you can only have one wife. And if you have, if you sire children with a concubine or something like that, they are not legitimate. They cannot inherit. And that's, that was, you know, that was the marriage regime. Now, I do believe that there are also biological tendencies towards monogamy because, you know, evolving in the far north, you're not going to be able to have some kind of intensive, you know, despot having hundreds of wives or something like that. But in the Middle Ages, you had quite wealthy kings, and some of them, you know, had these proclivities, and the church came down on them. And especially, and I make a big deal about the papal revolution and you know, the 11th century, 12th century. This was the high point of Christendom, of the Catholic Church, let's put it that way. Because they before that, the church was sort of this arm of the aristocracy. There was a lot of nepotism going on. You know, you'd have this nobleman and he'd make his son the bishop or something like that. There's a lot of corruption in the church. And it just really, you know, was not even what you call, want to think of as a religious institution. But in the 11th, 12th centuries, you had these crusading popes, and they had this monastic background. They cleaned it all up. They got rid of all those people. They had, you know, they really clamped down so that you didn't have any priests who were having even concubines. They forced celibacy on priests. Bishops, and this was not done before. You had all these bishops who had children, and they were had families, and they were, you know, making big money, and you know, highly connected to the local aristocracy and all that. They got rid of that, and what that did was create the image of the church as this altruistic institution that was able to really command people's respect and allegiance. And that is a big, this the reason why the church was so powerful in the Middle Ages. It was able to command people's respect and allegiance. And so if you're a king, you couldn't really mess with the church that much. You could defy it to some extent. And some kings did more or less do that. But, the church had a lot of power because, the church could excommunicate the king. The king of France wants to divorce his wife. Well, the church says, well, no, you can't divorce it. King says, well, I haven't even had any children. We can't seem to make any babies, and I need to have an heir. Doesn't matter. You can't get divorced. And that was, you know, that's what, you know, led Henry VIII to actually leave the church.
Right. And you know, that's a fascinating departure, because I was recently just watching a series about that, about Henry VIII and the Protestant Reformation and, yeah, and his, you know, how his lust for Anne Boleyn, you know, basically had a huge part in the history of the West.
Yeah, a huge part. So that's what made the church so powerful, and they used their power, no question. I mean, the church was a player in the Middle Ages, and a long time later, they were, you know, having big input into the decisions of kings and you know, really involved in the power politics of Europe. They also opposed the power of extended kinship groups. So the church was on the side of individualism and creating more individualistic culture than already previously existed. So you did have some kinship groups. The Germans called them Sippe, I guess, S-I-P-P-E. But the church acted against them because they were a rival to the church power. They acted against the various, you know, feudal lords because they were sort of powers in their own right, and they got as much power as they could against kings and against the cities that were developing. So it was you know, they became a player in the power politics of Europe. And I, you know, at the same time, they had this image of altruism, of a reproductive altruism, with these celibate males at the top of this thing. And it was extremely effective. I mean, one of the personalities that stands out in my mind in the Middle Ages is St. Louis, the King Louis IX of France. He's the guy who built, or partly built Notre Dame in Paris. He lived like a monk. This is the guy, he's the wealthiest guy in Europe. lived like a monk, had like a whole bunch of children, I don't know, 10, 12, a whole lot of children. He went on crusades. And he really did his best for the people, I believe. I mean, he wasn't, you know, like so many later monarchs, where they were, it was all about their glory and taxing the people up to the hilt and making alliances with the Jews and things like that to exploit the people. Henry, King Louis actually, you know, prevented the Jews from, you know, money lending and that sort of thing. Jews were not given that kind of favorable treatment that they got in so many other places, and were able to really exploit the people. So he's a sort of icon of a European aristocrat who really was, you know, someone who would be someone you'd want to emulate. Unfortunately, there were so many who were not that way. The aristocracy became corrupt. You know, became obviously corrupt. And this, I think, led partly to the world that we see now.
I think we'll have some follow-up questions to this particular subtopic when we open the floor up for questions. In the meantime, folks, and we will do that, by the way, in about 20 minutes' time. So we're going to work a little overtime tonight. We typically go 90 minutes and then we call it. We'll go a little bit overtime tonight because we had the disruption with the technical difficulties. But support our guy and go to Amazon.com. I want to see his rank on the best-selling ladder climb in real time. So go to Amazon.com. Kevin McDonald book.
I won't object to that.
You can just search Kevin McDonald book, or you can put in the full title if you so choose. And that is, of course, Individualism and the Western Liberal Tradition, Evolutionary Origins, History, and Prospects for the Future. Let's see his rank on the best-selling ladder be vaulted up before the end of the stream here tonight. Now, while we're on the topic, I've got a couple of questions left for you, Kevin, and then we're going to open it up to those assembled in the chat room. By the way, if you are in the chat room, please do, one more time, let me remind you to take that link to our live stream and post it on your social media, Twitter, Facebook, whatever you're on, and bring some folks in so they can have the opportunity to ask questions of Dr. McDonald, a rare privilege indeed. So the Protestant Reformation, and particularly the Puritans in England and the U.S., were a big force in Western history. You essentially see Puritanism as exemplifying the egalitarian individualist aspect of Western culture. And I'd ask you to delve into that just a bit. The Puritans, of course, were an incredibly successful and influential group in American history, dominating U.S. culture because of their role in founding and dominating the Ivy League universities and media in the North and producing a highly productive capitalist acquisitive culture. But in their social attitudes, they were generally on the left in today's terms. So I would ask you, I guess, a two-part question. Your thoughts on their role in the development of the West and their attitudes on slavery and their role in promoting the war between the states.
Yeah, I think this is a fascinating topic. And this is chapter 6 of the book. I start out with the idea that Puritanism really was a group strategy. I mean, and sort of evolutionary strategy. John Calvin developed the idea of very strong social controls on people. It was very collectivist in many ways. I mean, we talk about individualism, but Puritans, you know, were perforce on the same page. They had, you know, people were monitoring every little thing they did. But as you say, this was, this became a dominant group in the United States. So this, they found, I mean, they were very intelligent people. These were the Puritans. They came from England in the 1620s. By 1636, they'd established Harvard. It was a few years, like 6-7 years after they landed in the Boston area there. They prized education. They'd set up all the public school system and compulsory public education for children. They were very business oriented and successful at that. They had an awful lot of children. They were the highest fertility rates ever recorded. And they ended up spreading across the country from the Boston area, New England, all the way across to Portland, Oregon. So it's an amazing success story, really. A hugely successful group biologically, a hugely successful group culturally. But one of the things about them, you know, and say, you know, after the, you know, in the 19th century, their intellectuals became much more secular. They were still very religious in a way, and they developed religious, like the Unitarian Church, which is not very, you know, religious really. But it's very liberal politically. And so you had this intellectual elite coming out of Harvard and other Ivy League schools. And they were very much into social activism for the poor, for immigrants, and on behalf of the slaves. They hated slavery. These were the activists when it came to the anti-slavery movement. Julia Ward Howe, who wrote the Battle Hymn of the Republic, she was of Puritan descent. Abraham Lincoln was of Puritan descent. They were much prone to sort of moral idealism, creating these utopian communities. Brook Farm in Massachusetts, they would have an idea of, this is the ideal society. We're going to create this ideal society. And they didn't care about, you know, any kind of human proclivities, you know, biological urges, anything like that. They were going to create this utopian ideal society, and it'll work just wonderfully. Well, of course, Brook Farm crashed. It wasn't too long after they started. You had a lot of other similar things like that. But they kept erecting these sort of ideal moral worlds. And so we talked before about moral communities. They hunter-gatherer groups of moral communities. Puritans erected moral communities within Boston in the early days. But then when they, started reaching out to the rest of the country via their role in the media and the academic world and everything, it was much more secular and had moral idealism. And so I have a lot on moral idealism of the 19th century. Abraham Lincoln personified this. Citing a very, very, very interesting books by Ernest Tubison, for example, University of Chicago Press, talking about this sort of utopian idealism that just pervades these people, this sort of millenarian sentiment. And they get all worked up for these moral causes. And then it's a fight between good and evil, absolute good against absolute evil. And that really defined the sort of Puritan intellectual outlook in the 19th century. I make the obvious connections that we see this in all American wars. Every one of our wars has been framed as this moral crusade, from Saddam Hussein to World War II, World War I, and certainly the Civil War. There were a lot of complexities about the causes of the Civil War, but if you look at the Puritan intellectuals and the people who really believed and in this moral utopia that would develop after the Civil War, after we eradicated this evil from the world, they were total believers in this. And in general, however, as Tubison points out, I mean, after this period, when the battle's over, there's this sort of reality sets in, cynicism tends to set in, and we do the whole cycle over again. And it's sort of obvious that Americans are still in this mode where they're very prone to this moralistic idealism, which is now, of course, routinely manipulated by the media. So we see, again, I mentioned Saddam Hussein, the run-up to the Iraq War. Now we're probably going to get the same thing, arguing the same thing about Iran. But that's really the Puritan legacy. But I also, in that chapter, at the end of the chapter, I have a section on the period of ethnic defense, because people started to realize the 19th century was very optimistic. I mean, things are going to work out. We can absorb all these new people and they'll become just like us. They'll become Protestant, white Protestant people. Even black people they'll just blend with us. We'll all be white Protestants in the end, looking poor Catholics, whatever. People started realizing that was naive at the end of the semester of the century. And these pure intellectuals started to have less that were dominant in the early part of the century, like Ralph Waldo Emerson and people like that, got less and less influential. And what got the people that really got influential were followers of Charles Darwin, very much to my approval and liking. These people understood Darwin. They saw the world as competitive. They didn't have this sort of moralistic utopianism that, and these were from the same stock. And these are like Madison Grant, Lothrop Stoddard, they're coming out of Harvard, very elite people. They were publishing in the best publishing houses and everything. And there was started to be sentiment against all this immigration, especially immigration from Eastern Europe, because these people were different. And really a big part of that was Jewish immigration. And this is something that Jewish organizations and Jews who are up on their own history are very acutely aware of. They view the 1924 immigration law as a slap in the face. So this was a period when the American people decided to rise up and really defend their ethnic interests. They did it not by expelling Jews or anybody who was here, but they did it by setting quotas on immigration and thinking that would be enough to create an ethnic status quo. But this was a period, a high water period of Darwinism in the social sciences. All these elite people, Henry Ford, Luther Burbank, Kellogg, David Starr Jordan, the president of Stanford, Lowell, the president of Harvard, was vice president of the Immigration Restriction League. So these were elite people, WASPs, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, leading the charge for ethnic defense. But it was short-lived, because at the same time, we talk about the Jewish immigration, you had the arrival of Franz Boas. Then he goes to Columbia. He sets his coterie. And the next thing you know, the American Anthropological Association is dominated by Boas and his students. And it's a very different outlook. They hate Darwin. They all into cultural relativism. And it really sets the stage for my book, The Culture of Critique. Because what you have then after that, after this period of ethnic defense, which ended with the 1924 immigration law, but it really extended to 1965, because even in 1952, the Congress overrode President Truman's veto of this immigration bill. It essentially reiterated the 1924 law. So this was an ethnic status quo law. It is regarded as the epitome of evil these days. This is why the 1950s are regarded by the left as the absolute worst period in American history. Well, maybe there's others, but this was a horrible period, because this was a period when the American people still had this idea that they wanted to stay the way they were. They wanted to remain a white society. And that lasted, of course, until 1965. And this is how this book on individualism intersects with the culture of critique, because, I've got all this material in the culture of critique on the rise of this Jewish elite, intellectual elite, political elite, and with the rise of the immigration law of 1965, which opened up immigration to all the peoples of the world. This was a Jewish project that really began, as soon as the 1924 law was on the books. They opposed this. They couldn't do much. During the 1930s, of course, there was poverty. Any kind of immigration, extensive immigration was out of the question, although they continued to lobby for Jewish refugees and so on. But it really didn't amount to much, and there was a lot of opposition. Even Roosevelt didn't go for that. And then after World War II, they kept up the heat. And this was at a time when anti-Semitism was at a low in American history. Anti-Semitism dropped off the table. During the 1930s, you had Father Coghlan, you had Henry Ford before that. And there was a lot of anti-Jewish sentiment in America. But after World War II, it completely dissipated. But the Jewish organizations just responded to that by stepping up their campaign to open up immigration to all the peoples of the world. And that's why we have the 1965 immigration law, fundamentally a result of Jewish activism. I try to demonstrate in the culture of critique. I don't talk about that in this book, but that is the reality. And it really shows how these two books do intersect and sort of form bookends with each other.
Folks, in 10 minutes, we're going to open up the floor and the chat room for those of you there assembled and take your questions for Dr. Kevin McDonald. And we have had the opportunity for the last nearly hour to learn more about his latest book, which is available for sale tonight at Amazon.com. I know a couple of people in the chat have mentioned that they have purchased it since we started the stream. So we want to encourage you more of you to do that. Kevin, we've got 10 minutes. 10 minutes. We're going to open up the floor. I've got three questions, so we'll have to really make haste to get them all in. I think they are
okay.
All
I'll do important.
Let's do what we can.
Yeah.
Because we don't want to shortchange the audience. But I want to ask, these days, white people in Western culture are routinely blamed, of course, as you know, as everyone knows, for slavery as if it were an exclusively white enterprise and colonialism. But you argue that Western Europeans are the only cultural group to abolish slavery for moral reasons, and that by the 19th century, the British Empire was a kinder, gentler place. Please explain how this came about, because obviously this involves a dramatic change from earlier attitudes.
It's a dramatic change. And again, what I ascribe it to fundamentally is you have the eclipse of this older European hierarchical aristocratic culture with this much more egalitarian moral, where culture is based on sort of your moral reputation. So chapter 7 really discusses in detail the anti-slavery movements of the 18th century. These were incredibly important historically. And as I said, the West, Western culture, really in particular, European in America and in Britain, were the only cultures that abolished slavery. So chapter 7 focuses on Britain, the anti-slavery movement there. And again, you can see the Puritan influence in the background, but the big activists were the Quakers and the Methodists were involved, the so-called evangelical Anglicans and other groups. So it was an important, full court press, and they used people's empathy, their natural empathy to have a revulsion against slavery. They would show pictures of slaves. They would write tracts about how slaves were abused. They would show them crowded together on a slaving ship. They would show them manacled and begging for mercy and stuff. So those images were disseminated in newspapers and tracts and handed out to people. And even by the middle of the 18th century, it's very common for people in Britain. If they did a public opinion survey, they probably found most people were against it. But of course, there were big commercial interests in favor of slavery. It took until really the end of the 1780s, it really started to pick up, and then it got going in Parliament. The slave trade was abolished in 1807, and slavery in 1831, I believe. And the British Empire in general was much more a kinder, gentler place. I mean, America, a very interesting book by David Hackett Fisher. He was an awesome historian. He talked about the contrast between the American situation versus what happened in New Zealand. In America, you had an oppressive regime back home, this aristocratic government in England, really trying to milk the colonies for all they're worth, versus in New Zealand by the 1840s, it was settled much later. And just a much different sort of thing. They recruited people on the basis of moral qualities. They were much nicer to the native New Zealanders than we were to the Indians. In general, it was just they tried to be just and fair and all of that. So it was a much different scenario there than in America, really. But so that kindness, that gentleness. I also have a section in Andrew Joyce's very interesting paper on the Morant Bay Rebellion in Jamaica, because in that one, even though how the rebellion was crushed sort of reflected the old style way of treating the empire, there were an awful lot of people back in England who were objecting to that. And she had this liberal force in England. It was really the same people who were behind the anti-slavery movement. So that really became an important aspect of British culture. And of course, we see the same trends in American culture.
I mentioned that this book could be in some ways considered to be a history book, a history of our people. We, I think, mentioned just a moment ago that right now at Amazon.com, it is ranked number 2 in the category of Scandinavian history. You're an evolutionary psychologist, though, and a lot of this book deals with psychology. So my last question for you, I'm going to cut it a little short on my end so we can get to the chat room on time. How does this book tie into your work on evolutionary psychology? You claim that egalitarian individualists are prone to creating moral communities. In other words, communities not based on kinship, that Scandinavians are extreme on this tendency. How does that play out in the contemporary world where Sweden, for example, has declared itself a humanitarian superpower and a stifling groupthink has developed around the question of migration?
Yeah, so I have a chapter on psychological mechanisms of moral communities. And evolutionary psychology figures in other chapters. I talk about ideology, and Christian ideology in the Middle Ages, of sinfulness of sex and things like that. And the importance of ideology can't be overestimated. I talk about personality and altruism and empathy. Because empathy, we talked about empathy a lot in the section on slavery and anti-slavery movement. And so we want to understand that from a psychological perspective, how it relates to personality and how it relates to altruism. I talk about pathological altruism, that not very many people, but some people are extreme on this trait of altruism to the point of being self-sacrificing, actually harming themselves. And we're starting to see that today. A lot of social justice warrior white activists. We see that white people adopting people from Africa rather than other people, white people, children from around here. And so I try to explore the psychology of empathy and altruism and morality, social identity, and ethnocentrism. I want to understand ethnocentrism. And I talk about Richard Lynn's recent book on race differences in personality. White people are the most altruistic people on the planet. And we're seeing that now. And no other culture group is doing what white people are, just admitting millions of people for some kind of moral imperative as it is framed in the media. So a big part of that is to talk about manipulation of elite culture by the media, where they are able to create these moral communities. And make you feel like you're a bad person if you oppose every last person on earth coming here. And so that is an important aspect of the current situation where white people feel a moral imperative to do these things. I'll try to explain why that is. I also have sections on psychological mechanisms that will actually help us. Because obviously these other mechanisms are working against us now. We want to be a good person. We want to, have a good reputation. And so you don't dissent from this absolutely disastrous regime of immigration. But there are mechanisms for ethnocentrism. And one of the things I really stress is anti-white hate is increasing white identity and a sense of white interest. I thought it was interesting today. You look at Ann Coulter's Twitter feed today. She got several tweets on anti-white hatred. And, I've never seen her do that before. And I think it's something that we really should emphasize, that this is becoming mainstream. The New York Times, Sarah Jeong, and her tweets, they didn't care that she was anti-white. They could hire her. There are all these anti-white professors and media figures now. And they're coming out. They're publishing things in Huffington Post and Slate. They're on MSNBC and so on. This is happening, but it's really having effect. And I try to demonstrate that in the polling data on white people identifying more as white, feeling, if you ask white people, if you tell a white person, you know, white people are going to be a minority within, say, 20 years or something like that. They do not like to hear that. A lot of white people aren't even aware of that. And when they hear it, they don't react favorably because they instinctively, they don't want to be a minority. What do you want to be a minority for? Minorities have never, you know, they always have to sort of jockey for their position and hope that other people treat them well. Well, you know, that's a big factor, I think, now in the coming decades, is we're going to see more and more white identity, more white people willing to assert white interests.
Kevin, I'm going to take a question from the chat, but first I'd like to preface it with this. Your overall perspective is that there were three major upheavals in the West. The ancient Indo-Europeans establishing their culture, which we've touched on, the rise of Protestantism, particularly in the 17th century, and the 1960s countercultural revolution. You argued that the Protestant groups, like the Puritans, developed moral communities in which dissenters were shunned and ostracized. But in the last chapter of your book, you claimed that the 1960s revolution was different because it has been defined by the rise of Jews as a hostile elite able to create a moral community by their influence in the media and the academic world. Within this new moral community, whites who stand up for their people are the ones who are ostracized and vilified. And boy, don't we know it.
Why don't we know it?
And for the future of individualism in the West.
Well, I do think that individualism is going to be under threat for the reasons I was just mentioning a minute ago. I think that white people are going to coalesce more. We're going to identify more as white. We're going to see ourselves as having interests with other white people because we are under siege, and obviously so. As I said, I think the 1960s are a big, you know, watershed moment in Western history. The United States, it certainly was. I lived through it. I saw it happen. And what you see, a little appendix on the decline of our culture since 1960, huge rise in unwed mothers and divorce and all this disasters within the family, the opioid epidemic, which is disproportionately affecting working class people. All these changes have really impacted the working class far more than the other groups because they are far more dependent on cultural supports. Through the 1950s, we had strong cultural supports in this country based on religion and sort of common sense of customs and morals. You know, there were two sexes and you're supposed to grow up and get married and have kids and that sort of thing. Now, you know, it's completely different. So this watershed 1960s, and the main thing about it, of course, is immigration. You know, that unlike previous groups, you know, the Protestant elites that ran this country really through the 1950s did not see themselves as really that different from the rest of us. And they were basically on our side, and we felt a certain cohesion. This new elite does not feel that way. This is globalism now. And this is hatred really towards the traditional American white majority. And so what we're seeing is this immigration, multicultural immigration from all over the world. We're seeing this dramatic sea change. This is a fundamental change, as big as a change as the Protestant Reformation, in my opinion. Because it's going to, you know, you could change things in directions within the Protestant in the ensuing centuries. But once you've created all these facts on the ground with tens of millions of people colonizing the West, how do you undo that? I mean, if you want to preserve your people and your culture, where do you go now? Because, you know, you're really up against the wall, and we're talking about either a cataclysm or just peacefully going into the night. And I do raise the possibility. I think a civil war of some kind, a race war, is not out of the question.
Donald Trump said there's going to be a civil war if he gets impeached, so...
What?
I believe it was Donald Trump who retweeted.
Yeah, I saw that today, and I tweeted about it. I said, he didn't say a civil war. He said he was quoting this reverend guy. pastor, right. Yeah, saying it would be a break like the Civil War, like sort of a break, meaning not the war, but the polarization. And we're seeing that now. All the political polls, you see this polarization. We can't talk to each other anymore. You know, there's no common ground. It's like before the Civil War in the 1860, you know, where there's no way to talk to these people. And so you, the only thing to do is either fight or go home. And, you know, you just wonder what the future portends, really. It's going to be really exciting times. And the Chinese proverb, you don't really want to live through exciting
times. That's right. Yeah, the Chinese said it. That's right.
You're late because of pain.
May you live in interesting times. Well, we certainly do. It's very interesting. We're going to figure out within a generation or two if we're going to survive or not. So that is, I believe you could say, interesting. So, okay, on top of all of the technical difficulties we've had tonight, my chat feed froze, so I relaunched it. And then instead of what I feared was a lot of silence, there were an avalanche of questions coming in for you, Kevin, that were unbeknownst to me. And so we just now received those. We're going to get to those, and we're opening up the floor for questions for Dr. McDonald. For the last hour and change, you have heard my interview with him about the contents of his book and how you can own your own copy by going to Amazon, search for Kevin McDonald book. The title is Individualism and the Western Liberal Tradition, Evolutionary Origins, History, and Prospects for the Future. So for the remaining time that we have tonight, and I know we've gone way over because of the hiccups that we had at the beginning, but we're going to take your questions. So Kevin, you know how this works once we get to this stage of any given TOQ live broadcast. We're going to take as many as we can, as quickly as we can.
Right.
We can accommodate as many folks as possible. So this question has been waiting in queue for quite some time now. Do you think the net effect of Christian rule for some 1800 years in Europe was good or bad?
Well, I'd have to say it was good, but it was corruptible is the problem. And we see how corruptible it is. I don't think Christianity per se has been leading our culture for a very long time. Christianity has been following the leads of the secular culture. But, you know, you through the 19th century, well into the 20th century, there were strong religious currents in this country. And there still are in some sectors, but, you know, it's diminishing. And so many churches have been taken over by political correctness. I mean, including your church, James, I believe, and certainly the Catholic Church and other the mainline Protestant churches. You know, right now we don't see much hope in the Christian in Christianity in America for our people. But you have to remember that we rose to world power via Christianity. There have been times when Christianity has been in the forefront of defending the West, as in the Reconquista in Spain. You know, the Battle of Lepanto with the Turks, Charles Martel and Tours in the 8th century. So this is, you know, it's a complex thing, and it's hard to balance the two. But, you know, unfortunately, the unfortunate part of Christianity is that it's always had this moral universalism. You know, all God's people are have souls, and you know, it was a very egalitarian message, and this was part of their pitch in the Middle Ages. It was a pitch in the Roman times when the Christianity took off in the Roman Empire with a very against a very corrupt, evil culture in a lot of ways in the Roman Empire. But it, you know, really is follows now. I mean, you look at these churches and they just mouth typical social justice things. They promote immigration in various ways.
Well, let's actually get into that. And again, as quickly as we can, because we have quite a lineup of questions here. And only about 20 minutes left in this extended version of TOQ Live. You know, of course, I think that Christianity has been a net positive for us, but there's no doubt, like any other institution, whether you're talking about media, academia, government, entertainment, what have you.
Yeah.
It has certainly been taken over by the elites and by the powers that be right now. Question. Right. Let's try to take these maybe 60 seconds, 90 seconds or less, so we can get to them all.
Okay, sorry, yeah.
Hey, flood.
I'm running out of my mouth here.
Why does the Catholic Church, and they put church in quotations, how did it become such an advocate and instrument of invasionary migration?
Well, you know, that's another story. We have a number of articles on the subversion of the Catholic Church. It's like so many other things that have been subverted by the left in recent decades. Vatican Council of 1960, Vatican II, I think, around 1960. The church was, as I say, it always had this ideological problem of moral universalism that was okay within a European context, but now it's so easy for the left to make that into all God's children, meaning we should have Africans in Amsterdam. So it is vulnerable to that. And, again, religious thinking tends not to, I think religious thinking is more of a detriment than an asset, especially nowadays. Very big, very much so. That I'm a Darwinist. I think we should see things in a scientific, clear-eyed way about our future and what it portends, and we shouldn't get all hung up on religious things that get in the way of seeing it that way.
Well, you know, it is interesting, though, you make mention of the fact, and it is a fact, that while these European tribes always warred with one another, it wasn't until the banner of Christ came that they united and were able to stave off a Muslim invasion on more than one occasion, an invasion that would have most likely eradicated Europe as we know it. So, that is interesting to remember. And I think now if you look at the healthy nations of the West, you will find them in Eastern Europe and the traditional faith, or at least the faith of Christendom for the last several hundred years, is one of the catalysts in their renaissance, if you will. But of course, it's how you interpret the faith, because of course, that very same faith, you could argue, here, as interpreted in America, is leading us to our demise with the Catholic Church.
That's right. That's
and
right.
The Baptist and so on and so forth. So that leads us to our next question. On which Western country would you place your bets? Which country do you think will maintain a super white a white supermajority for the next 500 years?
What would I put a bet on? Well, you know, I was really hopeful for Italy for a while. Now they got rid of Salvini and they seem to be retrogressing. I'm always hopeful. The results of the Austrian election are in some ways encouraging. I would place least like would be something like Sweden. I think that they are just benighted in moral egalitarianism. And it really is also in groupthink. They can't question immigration. They just go along with it. All the disasters that are happening there, all the unemployment, the crime, but it doesn't seem to make any difference to them.
Yeah, but you know, it is interesting though, Kevin, how quickly things can change. Because if you look,
things can change, and I agree with James, and that's why we are here fighting all the time. We think they can change, and I do think that white people are very open to these messages. We have to get the word out, and they have to be aware that what we're saying is absolutely true, that there is an attempt to replace us. There's an attempt to lessen our political power, to make us a vulnerable population. And that when that happens, all the ancient hatreds are going to come out. You don't want to be an ethnic minority in a culture where you have all these ethnic grudges. You see what happened in the Bolshevik Revolution in the Soviet Union.
Exactly.
Russians came under the thumb of an alien elite that hated them, essentially. And they ended up murdering 20 million of them.
Well, Kevin, pardon the interruption, but this is my point. If you look at America, let's just say America in 1940 and the Soviet Union or Russia in 1940, and you said, go 80 years into the future, which of these two nations do you think may be a key to white survival in the future? Would you have thought it would have been America, which was so healthy and wholesome in the 1940s, pre-World War II, and certainly pre, you know, the 60s, 70s revolution? Or do you think Russia, which was under the throes and the thumb of the Bolshevik and the communist menace, and then, but you fast forward just 80 short years, which is relatively short in the history of our world, and now it is the Eastern Europe that may be our salvation, and certainly not the formerly Christian West.
Yeah, but you know, the old Marxist ideology was class struggle. They didn't have the ideology of the act to import millions of people. That's the Frankfurt School, and that's what, you know, Jewish activism, their conclusion after World War II was, we can't trust white people. They can rise up against us, like what happened in Germany. And so the only solution really is to import non-whites and to lessen their power. And I think, and you know, to pathologize being white, which is what the Frankfurt School and then the Legion of Jewish Activists and Academics and Jewish organizations, that's what they've been pushing for the last, since World War II, basically. So that's what we're up against. So, but yeah, things can change. But the problem is, you know, what they didn't do in the Soviet Union or Eastern Europe was import all these people. They're trying to get the EU is trying to get Eastern Europe to do that. They're digging in their heels. They're standing up for the people, basically. But in Russia now, it's, you know, Russia has its own problems because they have this Muslim populations over there. But anyway,
They've got problems, but you know, you look at Hungary, for example, with its border, and it's, I mean, they're certainly much better off, I think, Poland, by any standard of measurement, these are healthier societies than we're
in. Yeah, much healthier.
But all right, so we really have to make haste here, and I hate
to be
repetitious and repeat myself, but with 15 minutes remaining, we've got more questions than we'll ever get to. So we're going to have to take these a minute or less a piece. Here we go. We seem to have built the question.
Lightning round.
We seem to have no built-in ethnic defenses. What can we do going forward to save what's left of Western civilization?
Well, we do have some ethnic defenses. As I said, we have a tendency to respond negatively to the anti-white rhetoric around this now. You see things like white flight, what we call implicit whiteness. It's not enough. I talk about that quite a bit in chapter 8. It's not enough for a right revival, but it shows that white people still have a sense. They'd really rather live around other white people. They have more in common with them. They join clubs and things and move to places where there are other white people. They take their kids to schools with other white kids. So those instincts are still there. And as I said, I think with the hyperpolarization, the vilification of white people, when white people start really thinking about and being told, you're going to be a minority. And what do you think is going to happen then? You know, when you have all these haters coming in here and you see the visceral hatred on the left now towards white people, it's just stunning. You know, and I think it's a wake up call, and it is making white people identify more as white and think of white interests.
This is a generalized question. I guess you'll have to interpret it as you might and answer it based upon your interpretation. But would walking off the plantation, or as I put it, abjuring the realm in mass, be a good strategy?
What does he mean by that?
Exactly. Well, I
didn't mean being off the grid, or
I don't know if it means necessarily off the grid or just. Well, I mean, perhaps standing as a dissident, I guess, is one way you could interpret it. I guess it depends. The answer must depend on your interpretation of the question. But I think it's a provocative question in some ways. But let me just rephrase it and put it in my own terms. What would be the path forward for whites who want to live a healthy and prosperous life in this degenerate day and age and make a positive impact without slitting their own throats?
That's the thing, slitting your own throat. That is the issue, that because there are all these informal things, you know, practices now where the ADL calls up your boss and you're fired the next day. And that's what happens routinely now. And they're proud of it. Southern Poverty Law Center. So this is a reality. You're a huge cost for many, many people to do this. And so that is the number one problem that we have. And believe me, they will continue that as long as they can. And they'll get rid of the First Amendment at the first opportunity because they want to shut down people like me and talking about this, books, podcasts, everything. They want to shut it down. So we will see more and more repression, but, you know, we can also see,
you know, well, I was just going to say though, you prompted me. Repression, yes, but it pales in comparison to what those people we were talking about just a moment ago faced, which was a bullet to the back of the head wherever they were found. You know, that's real oppression. The sacrifices we make, and they are real, you know, in terms of the constant and incessant defamation, libel, and slander, it really does pale in comparison to the sacrifice of blood and bone, which our betters gave. No one wants to be made uncomfortable, God knows, but at some point we may have to be uncomfortable to take back our patrimony.
Kevin, you worry sometimes that we're too comfortable, we're too well off.
We're in that cycle.
We want to suffer anymore.
We're not lean and hungry anymore. We're fat and lazy.
Fat and lazy.
Figuratively and in some cases, quite literally speaking. Do you envision whites, this is another question from the chat, and so many more to try to get to. Do you envision whites adapting to the invasion of our nations by the third world by becoming more tribalistic and less sentimental towards the other?
Yes, and that's what I'm saying, that we will, that we are. I mean, I part of Chapter 8, I try to say, I try to show by surveys and so on, we are becoming more tribal. We are becoming gradual, but it's gradual. And there's an awful lot of white people. I think there's still, white people still consist of like 44%, you know, around half of the vote of the Democratic Party. But most whites are coalescing in the Republican Party. Not that the Republicans are doing a lot for us, but they are because the left is becoming so extreme. You see so much anti-white hate. You see so much sort of sexual weirdness. And, these things are making white people more conscious, more aware. And I think in the long run, we will become more cohesive.
All right. Good question. Great answer. How do we, this is maybe a quick hit on this one, Kevin, if you can. How do we overcome the paranoia of surveillance society? And I see this a lot. People are so afraid of being doxxed. And it's not necessarily an irrational concern, but people are so afraid of being found out as being a reasonable and common sense, rational, human being that they handicap themselves. How do we overcome that?
Yeah, I think it's maybe not possible for a lot of people. You got a wife and three kids. What are you going to do? You risk your job? You can't do that. So that's their power right now. You know, that's their power. And it'd be great. You know, one of the things I've always advocated is that we have an infrastructure for activists, at least. People who do stick their neck out and get nailed, they get doxxed, they lose their job. We have to be able to fall back on something, be able to make a living, as an activist, working, say, for American Renaissance or V-Dare or something like that, and get a job so that it's not the end of the world if you get doxxed. We have to expect. I mean, just to be realistic, these people want to completely shut it down. And they would love to see every last alt-right, dissident right person in prison. They would love that. They have so much power. You know, if and when the left gets in again, and God knows, you know, the demographics are all on their side. You were looking at a permanent leftist majority in the foreseeable future. They keep imploring these people. They vote 80% for the Democrats. What do you expect is going to happen? How do these Republicans think that they can win in the future? It doesn't process. I mean, this is short-term thinking to the
Oh, sure. Well, that actually leads us to our next question. Kevin, we have done nearly a year's worth of these monthly installments. We've had the best guests you could possibly have, and there's never been a bad episode. They've all been stellar. I don't know if any of them have been as good as this, though, talking about your book, one-on-one with you, and the questions from the audience. And I'm going to cut off taking questions now. We still have several in queue that we want to get to. If you don't mind, I'll answer this question that just came in because it harkens back to how I cut my teeth in this movement, having started in 1999 working for Pat Buchanan, who has been a guest on my radio program several times. They asked, do you believe an identitarian party could succeed politically in America? I'll answer that by just saying simply no, not until there is a dramatic cultural shift, because I will tell you what perhaps you don't know is that the ballot access requirements are so hard to overcome, and they vary from state to state. Some states you can get in very easily. Some states it is impossible to get on. You obviously have to have ballot access in all 50 states. Some states you will not get ballot access unless you're a Republican or a Democrat. That's number one. Number two, of course, the financial is concerned. And then number three, the dirty tricks you can't even imagine that are waiting for anybody who begins to knock on the doorstep of credibility with regards to political success at the ballot box. So right now the answer is no. I mean, things will have to change incredibly before an identitarian party is able to compete at the ballot box. So Kevin, that being said, if you don't mind me answering that, back to you. Do you envision whites adapting to the invasion of our nations by the third world by becoming actually, we just asked that question. Never mind. All right, we're going to go on to the next one. That's good. That saves a little time. For Kevin, do you feel dysgenics has how do you feel dysgenics has affected us? Whites are underrepresented at Harvard and elite schools nowadays. Did we get lazier about education, or was it discrimination?
Well, there's certainly quite a bit of evidence for discrimination. Ron Unz is, I think, is a classic article that he wrote for American Conservative on the myth of the American meritocracy, and basically arguing that Jews are way overrepresented, not only in terms of their percentage of the population, but in terms of their academic performance. When Jewish academic performance is declining, but they remain at this high level, the people really being discriminated against are white Europeans. Having said that, there is some dysgenics, no question about it. Michael Woodley and Edward Dutton, people like that, have provided some evidence for that. I think that we had, in terms of natural selection, we've sort of relaxed natural selection because people don't die so easily as they did in the past, and we've cured so many diseases and so many weak people survive, and so that it's bound to have an effect on the group as a whole. And you see so many people now, they don't want to reproduce. They're sexually bizarre. You wonder how the Woodley's theory is that this is accumulation of deleterious genes because there haven't been much selective pressures in recent centuries.
All right, Kevin, how does an implicit identity group like NASCAR or country music pivot into a more explicit group?
Yeah, I have a section in Chapter 8 about NASCAR and a little bit on country music. They are white, implicit white communities, no question about it. And I think that they're, the kind of people who are on our side. And a lot of them may be explicitly, or at least when they're in their own thoughts, they're on our side. And they're in that sense explicitly so. But, they know how the world works now and what happens to such people. But, yeah, they're open to our messages. And those are the people. I mean, I think, white, working class Southerners, are the best bet, really. The white Southerners seem to have more of an identity, more of a historical sense of being a people than other sections of the white community. And I think they are, you know, both of those are really Southern phenomena, country music and NASCAR. And NASCAR, you know, often see Confederate flags and all that. So these people are really open to our messages. And if I were to bet, you know, lay some money on what part of the white population is going to wake up first, these are the people.
Well, you know, as I said in my talk at our joint venture a few weeks back, that the South still does have that important prerequisite for being an independent nation, and that is that we still do, as diluted and watered down as it may be, it is a separate culture from that of our surroundings.
Yes, it is.
The Confederacy does have a still distinct and separate culture from the rest of the United States. So perhaps if America is to reclaim her destiny, she'll first look to the South.
Yep.
All right, our last question. We have gone into super overtime here, but of course we had a late start. So our last question, and then we'll plug the book information one more time, and we'll try to leave on a little more positive note. Question to you, Kevin, of course, what is the most positive thing on our side right now? The questioner makes mention of the Oberlin College incident in which they had to pay a bakery $11 million for falsely accusing them of racial profiling, or more examples like this coming. What is the most positive thing we have going for us right now?
That's a good example, the Oberlin thing. And really what's going on there is the people on the left are just completely unhinged, you know, where they went to bat for these kids. For this guy, you know, even though he was guilty of sin, because, you know, it's got to be racism. You know, they're getting way beyond the data and just getting, as I say, I think the hatred that we see against white people is the biggest thing, the most obvious thing that is going to really turn white people around. And we see so much of it. Again, I mentioned Ann Coulter. I was surprised to see her today tweeting. She just said that we this incredible amount of white anti-white hatred these days. And then she tweeted about Sarah Young, and she tweeted two or three about them, you know, today. Well, that's the thing. We have to all get it through our head. They hate us. They hate us, okay? And they really want to destroy us. And who knows how far they'll go if they get power. You know, we have the what happened with the Bolshevik Revolution. We don't know where this will go. And 20th century, 21st century technology of social control and weaponry, you know, you're talking about some very dire possibilities here.
We had a wonderful, after it got started, a very wonderful and in-depth conversation about your new book, Kevin, and of course, great question and answers from the chat. That book, again, ladies and gentlemen, available for you right now at Amazon.com, is Individualism in the Western Liberal Tradition, Evolutionary Origins, History, and Prospects for the Future. You have heard for nearly the last 2 hours from its author, Dr. Kevin McDonald. We will repost this interview. If you've joined us late, we will repost it to our respective websites. You can, of course, catch it after it propagates, and our admin gets it posted to YouTube, the edited version. There it is. Take a look. Show that beautiful picture again of that book, Kevin. It will be up if you've joined
us. Here's the book right here. I'll tell you, it looks nice, I think, and that very big type and everything. I was happy the way it ended up. I didn't even know what it was going to look like until I got my hands on it. But, you know, pretty favorable. The print is too small and stuff. This is nice.
If you joined us late, if you joined us in progress, again, it's going to be posted in its entirety, the archive, I guess you could say, at theoccidentalobserver.net and my website as well. Kevin, a final word to you.
Well, I really enjoyed this, and it's a great opportunity to talk about all these issues. There's so much, as you can see. I mean, the book's got a lot of different themes in it, and so it's, you know, something that takes a little time to digest and think about.
Well, thankfully, we have the time to have an in-depth, deep dive into its contents and its inspirations and origins. And I think our entire audience is all the better for it. I have enjoyed spending my evening with you, my friend.
And yeah, I enjoyed it too. A few technical difficulties, but it worked out.
We got to the finish line one way or another. And again, folks, be sure to check out the Occidental Observer. I'm sure by tomorrow we will have this edited and up on YouTube, and it'll be posted in its entirety there. For Kevin McDonald, I'm James Edwards. We'll see you next month on TOQ Live. Good night, everybody.
All right. Well.